In the last episode, we discussed physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. In today's episode, we're going to explore arguments on both sides of these moral issues. To learn more, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. When confronted by a dying patient who is suffering and wants to die, physician-assisted suicide advocates argue that the most merciful thing to do is to stop needless suffering. After all, they argue, one of the principal aims of medicine is the alleviation of suffering. Further, they argue that we usually have no hesitation about relieving the suffering of animals when they're approaching death. Of course, the obvious response to this latter argument is that human beings are not animals. We are made in the image of God, so we don't treat people the same as we treat animals. Although, on a side note, I have to tell you really briefly an interesting story. One night years ago, I was out to dinner in San Francisco with a group of coworkers, and after dinner, we were walking around the city, and we saw where a group of people had set up a display of chickens in cramped cages. The people were arguing for chickens to have better living conditions. Interestingly, when they were asked about their stance on abortion, they admitted that they were in favor of it. So they were protesting the living conditions of chickens in factories, but thought it was okay to dismember innocent human beings growing in the womb. Now, I love animals and I take good care of my pets and livestock, but something is broken morally when we value the life of a chicken more than the life of a human being. To the argument that physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are needed to alleviate suffering, one response is that many doctors and other medical professionals argue that the pain of most patients can be adequately managed. They don't believe that physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia are necessary to fulfill the goal of medicine, which is to provide relief from suffering. Studies regarding end-of-life pain note that most pain in advanced illness can be relieved with optimal palliative care. I don't want to minimize pain and suffering at the end of life. I've witnessed it firsthand. But pain relief, even complete pain control, can often be achieved with a majority of patients. And in cases in which the pain is particularly difficult to control, there are other options, such as putting the person into an unconscious state before they die. Additionally, if the amount of pain relief necessary to control pain slows down the patient's heartbeat or breathing, it is morally justifiable under what is called the law of double effect to prescribe a sufficient dosage of medication to relieve the pain, even if one of the possible side effects is hastening, but not causing, the death of the patient. I experienced this firsthand with my husband when he was dying from ALS. In the final week of his life, he was really in a lot of pain, so the doctor prescribed a particular muscle relaxant medication. What I didn't realize was how compromised my husband's lungs already were. He couldn't talk and he could hardly swallow, but he seemed to be breathing okay. But when I administered the medication to relieve some of the muscular pain, unbeknownst to me, it exacerbated his compromised breathing and his lungs started filling up with carbon dioxide because he couldn't expel it efficiently. After a second dosage of the medication, he started struggling to breathe. So I called 911 and he was taken to the ER. The doctor suggested pumping the carbon dioxide out of his lungs and giving him oxygen to help him breathe more comfortably. But then I realized that it would only prolong the inevitable. He was emaciated and suffering. Thankfully, he was cognizant enough to make the final decision, so I let him decide with a thumbs up or a thumbs down if he wanted to be treated and return home, or if he wanted to go to heaven. And he gave me a thumbs up for heaven. So he was put on a morphine drip to stay comfortable while we let nature take its course. The medicine prescribed by the doctor and administered by me didn't cause my husband to die. He died from the complications of ALS, but the medicine inadvertently hastened his death at the end. And I believe it was the mercy of God sparing him from more suffering. Morally, the intent in a situation like this is critical. If the intent was to take the patient's life, then that would be a direct killing of the patient. But if the intent is pain relief and the patient's death is hastened but not caused by the medication, that is a very different situation. It's interesting that evidence from the Netherlands and from the state of Oregon suggests that fear of pain is not the primary motive for requesting physician-assisted suicide. It used to be in many U.S. states and in parts of Europe that physician-assisted suicide was only allowed if a patient was in unrelievable pain. But in many places, that is no longer a criterion. In addition, studies show that the connection between depression and the request for physician-assisted suicide is more significant than previously thought. In fact, one particular study showed that the main motivation for requesting physician-assisted suicide was depression, not a poor medical diagnosis or prognosis. In recent years, the primary argument for legalizing physician-assisted suicide is personal autonomy. Proponents insist that there is a fundamental right to die. They argue that the law generally protects the rights of individuals to make life's most private and personal decisions apart from interference by the government. And the government, for the most part, lets people make personal decisions related to marriage, family, child rearing, etc., based on the principle of the right to privacy. Supporters of physician-assisted suicide want to extend the right to privacy to end one's life. They contend that the timing and manner of one's death are personal and private, so they should be protected by the right to privacy. But the opponents of physician-assisted suicide maintain that personal autonomy is not absolute. There are things one cannot morally do to one's body, such as put illegal drugs into it or use it for prostitution. Further, when there has been a conflict of autonomy versus the rights of others usually take precedence, especially if having autonomy can cause harm to others. Opponents of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia argue that opening the door to them begins a slippery slope. Data from the Dutch experience of euthanasia strongly suggest that terminally ill people are being administered euthanasia without their consent. Some proponents of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia agree that non-voluntary euthanasia is clearly immoral and it should not be done without the consent of the terminally ill patient. But some proponents maintain that consent is not always necessary and that non-consensual euthanasia could be morally acceptable for those for whom we would presume consent, or if they cannot enjoy a quality of life at a particular threshold, or if they are severely cognitively impaired. In response to this position, there is a very valid concern that if physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are legalized, that there will be irresistible pressure to pursue non-consensual euthanasia. So legalizing it could pose a threat. While some people could exercise their autonomy, others could be harmed. and the potential harm should override the right to privacy and personal liberty. Another way to respond to the argument from personal autonomy is to insist that if the right to die is grounded in personal autonomy, then it is a universal right. The argument goes that if everyone has autonomy over these key personal decisions, then everyone has the right to determine the timing and manner of one's death. So the right to die with physician-assisted suicide can't be limited to the terminally ill. It must be available to everyone, regardless of age or illness. Do you see the direction this could go in? Proponents of physician-assisted suicide insist that it would be limited, and it should be limited. But one can argue that if it is allowed based on the principle of personal autonomy, then you can't limit who gets to utilize it. Also, the argument from autonomy is a problem when looking at it from a Christian worldview. In the Bible, a person's autonomy over his or her life is not absolute, like many in our culture take it to be. Our autonomy is limited because we belong to Jesus, and obedience to him is primary. Paul teaches that our bodies are not our own because they have been redeemed or bought by Jesus. Plus, as I've mentioned previously, the Bible is clear that the timing and manner of one's death belong to God alone. God is sovereign over all of life, and he is the one who appoints the time to be born and the time to die for each one of us. This long-standing part of Christian tradition played a role in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision not to recognize a constitutionally protected right to die. Because in American history, there is a long tradition against suicide. One question that arises is whether or not physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia involve literally killing a person. It's similar to the argument for abortion that is based on not viewing the fetus as a person. Some proponents of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia distinguish between being alive, your biological or physiological life, and having a life, what they refer to as your biographical life, in other words, what they would define as a meaningful life. This is a dangerous distinction by saying that some people are human beings, but not really a person. They're alive, but they are so ill or so impaired that it could be said that the person's life is gone. Some view the unborn this way. Others view certain types of severely disabled newborns as human beings, but not persons. Some argue that terminally ill elderly people are so debilitated or demented that they cannot reasonably be called persons. It's common to view patients who are in an irreversible coma or a permanent vegetative state in this way, merely as bodies with physiological function but with no life. In these cases, physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia proponents insist that they're not killing a person. So they're not breaking the sixth commandment against killing. They believe that the person is, in a sense, already dead, since their biographical life has no more meaning. So they are ending only the physiological or biological functioning of the body. Of course, we would reject this distinction between being alive and having a life. A human being has an essence. Personhood is not lost just because the ability to exercise some capacities has been lost. Losing the function is not the same as losing the essence. If a person takes the pro-physician-assisted suicide argument to its logical conclusion, meaning if it's true that having a life is what gives life its value, and if only a body remains when the biographical life is gone, then would it be justifiable to strip that person of all of their rights? Could we conduct experiments on them? Could we harvest their organs without their permission? If the essentials of one's life and one's rights are tied up with biographical life and that's lost, how would you prevent abusive scenarios? What might be the social consequences of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia? Supporters believe that when it's done at a patient's request, it's a win-win situation. The patient's suffering is ended. The high cost of expensive terminal medical care is avoided. The family can grieve appropriately and then get on with their lives. And the medical staff can avoid the stress and anxiety of a long, drawn-out dying process. Additionally, they argue on a societal level, physician-assisted suicide could save the healthcare system some money. But opponents argue that there are undesirable social consequences that will result if physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are legalized. First, it could lead to non-voluntary aid in dying. A person may feel pressured to end their life not because they're tired of living, but because of the financial or other pressures that it puts on family members. A lot of elderly or ill people feel guilty about the drain that they cause on their family's resources, and they don't know how to justify their continued existence. They may feel like they have a duty to die. And what about doing it without their consent? In the Netherlands, there is evidence that non-voluntary euthanasia is occurring at an alarming rate. Based on physicians' self-reporting, in as many as 25% of the cases of euthanasia, it is done without the person's consent. How would you stop the coercion or pressure? It would be impossible. And there is the concern of the slippery slope in which euthanasia moves beyond the terminally ill to people with other non-terminally ill quality of life circumstances, such as people with Alzheimer's disease or other degenerative brain diseases, and the severely mentally disabled. I don't know the status now, but previously there was a movement in the Netherlands to perform euthanasia on certain classes of disabled newborns. And those who are old or disabled who desire to continue living, if their lives are deemed by others as useless, then their desire to stay alive could be regarded as immoral, and they might be pressured into believing that the right to die is really a duty to die. This pressure would affect the weakest and most vulnerable in society. If this seems like a situation that would never happen, think back to the euthanasia and eugenics programs of the 1930s and 1940s. The idea that some people are useless eaters, or that someone could be a human being but not a full person with inalienable rights. These ideas began in the salons of Europe and with the elites in the United States long before the Nazis came into power in Germany. And the ideas went down the slippery slope even further when the Nazis decided to use eugenics to create a master race by getting rid of those they deemed deficient. If non-voluntary euthanasia happens today in a society like the Netherlands, which has very generous universal healthcare provisions, what could happen in a place like the United States or other countries with different healthcare systems and also a considerable number of uninsured? The pressure on the old, frail, and disabled would be even more intense. With more direct financial incentives governing healthcare, legislation could provide inducements to incentivize physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. As a result, good end-of-life care could become a luxury, available only to those who could afford it. And the rest who have been deemed a burden by society could be pressured as a moral obligation to die. As the demographic shift puts increasing strain on healthcare systems around the world, end-of-life issues will continue to become more acute. We need to be careful about extremes on either end of the spectrum. As I talked about in a previous episode, we should be cautious about using scarce and very expensive medical resources on futile treatments, because there is more to the sanctity of life than simply postponing an imminent death. Not every sanctity of life principle demands that every patient receive the most aggressive treatment available, especially if the treatment is no longer helpful to the patient, or it's more burdensome than beneficial to the patient, or if it is no longer desired by the patient. Even though it is appropriate to utilize reasonable medical means to prolong life, death is a conquered enemy, so we don't have to resist it at all times and in every way possible. But we also have to be very concerned about the other extreme of believing that some people should die because they are a drain on society, or they're not even considered fully a person anymore because of age, illness, disability, or being incapacitated in some way. All of life is intrinsically valuable to God, irrespective of its quality. And the biblical commands against killing innocent people, even if it seems merciful, should be a warning against assisted suicide and euthanasia. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.